I cashed out my 401k. That's literally all I had to my name. I bought a 11-unit building in Cincinnati. It was my first deal. I walked away from the job security of having a government job, and I went full-time into real estate investing and started building out my own thing. This is only 5 years ago, and today I got about $80 million of real estate, boutique hotels, apartment buildings, and short-term rentals. We got a couple companies, and we're rocking and rolling, dude. Everyone told me not to do it. They told me it was too risky. And my biggest takeaway looking back is all those risks are real. But on the other side of the balance scale is another risk, and it's this. I could be 80 years old one day, laying in my bed, staring at the ceiling, kicking myself because I never fucking tried anything in life. How about that risk? That's a risk, too, that a lot of people don't allude to.
Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast.
Stand back while I celebrate freedom.
The show where we help you achieve financial independence with the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps from guests who've already earned their freedom.
The flags of freedom fly.
Choose to do what you want.
What you want.
With who you want.
With who you want.
When you want.
When you want.
With another episode today. Now, here's your host, Brian Lubin.
All right. The man, the myth, the Summers. Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast. Brother, what's going on?
Brian, dude, appreciate you having me on, dude. Just getting dialed in, man. We just had the Cinco de Mayo weekend, and I'm like 11 days removed from giving up alcohol for a good stretch, a little season that I'm entering. And I must say, dude, I'm really loving this new season, man.
Yeah, I'm excited to dive into that. I can't believe you flew out all this way for this podcast, man.
Really, like, I know,
you
went, man.
You left your doorstep, you came to your office, and now here we are in sunny San Diego, man.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's a blast. I'm curious, what made you settle in San Diego out of all the different places to live and run your office? Because we're sitting here in your studio. It's beautiful. Your full team is here in person. Yeah. Why San Diego, and what made you choose to go the opposite of remote work and keep everybody here in the office?
Yeah, so I came down to San Diego for college, and I spent about 5 years down here. And so I had a really good taste of what that was like. Good weather, beautiful beaches, the vibe is cool, the people are amazing, the food is amazing. And so I left for 6 years after college, and I spent some time in Oklahoma City. Great people out there, great steakhouses. Oklahoma City Thunder, NBA basketball is cool, but not a great place to live. And then I spent about 5.5 years up in LA working before I came back to San Diego. And the reason I came back is because I don't know, man, I missed it. I just knew it had a place in my heart. And so when I left, I was like, dude, I got to get back. And I've been here ever since, dude. I love it here, man.
How important do you think environment is to success of you personally and your business?
Oh, dude, it's everything, man. It's not just location, but it's like where you live, where you wake up every morning, your drive into the gym, your walks, like all that stuff matters. I always say it's mindset. It's all mental. So when I wake up, like I got a spot here in San Diego. I never used to have this, but now I got a cool spot that's overlooking the entire city. And I see the beach, I see the water, I see the bay, I see the airplanes taking off and landing, and I get to look down on the entire city. And waking up to that every single morning, it motivates the shit out of me and inspires me. And dude, it just gives me a lot of clarity in terms of mindset and just forces me to think bigger. And I feel like I do more because of it.
I used to think that it didn't matter.
Yeah.
I was completely wrong.
Mm.
Because when you start your financial freedom journey, right? It's like, all right, I'm not going to rent anymore. I'm not going to be like a sucker. I'm going to go buy my assets, buy my stuff. And so I was renting in an apartment that was in North Atlanta, and I was splitting it with a roommate. And then I moved out and I lived in the basement of my own house hacks. So it's just for 4 years, I lived in the basement of my own rental properties. And it wasn't like a bad situation, but I was living for free. And I was just like, I'm not going to be one of those chumps that rents places again or has these places. But now since that point, I went and traveled, like people know that listen, and now I have a penthouse apartment in Austin, Texas. I have my views over the water. I actually love renting right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm obsessed with it. I actually am not going to buy until I am going to buy like, you know, a forever house when I settle down, have kids, get married and everything.
Yeah, dude, that whole idea that you got to like own, you got to own your house in America, and they call it the quote unquote American dream. I don't think that worked 30 years ago, 40 years ago for our parents' generation, but what worked back then does not work today. And so when I hear people's parents and grandparents push this on this generation, I always tell people, I'm like, yes, that worked for them 40 years ago, but just because it worked back then does not mean that it's the best strategy for you today. And so I rent a penthouse as well down here in downtown San Diego. I pay $12,300 a month for this unit. And people might say, why are you renting? You're throwing away money. That unit I live in would probably be worth about $3 million if it was a condo. And if I was to buy that condo, I had to put down 10 to 20%. So let's just call it 20% down on $3 million. We're looking at $600,000 down. I'm going to have HOA, property taxes.
Maintenance.
And insurance, right? Maintenance, but also with the interest rate environment being in the sevens right now, my all-in HOA, all that sort of stuff, an HOA for a building like that would probably be $1,500 because you get the rooftop pool, you got the speakeasy, you got the gym, you got all this like cool stuff. Now, all in, my PITI and HOA for that property would probably be about $20,000, $21,000. So now I'm looking at $600,000 down just to get in, plus closing costs, and then $21,000 a month ongoing. And oh, by the way, when that HVAC unit breaks or the floor needs to be replaced or the cupboards, whatever, now I'm coming out of pocket. Now, I moved in for a $500 deposit. I got 1 month free, and I'm paying $12,300 a month. And guess what? After 18 months, 24 months, whenever I'm like, hey, I'm going to move on, I just throw in the keys and I'm good to go. I just walk away. I don't have to worry about selling it. I don't have to worry about timing the market and all this bull crap. Oh, people don't factor all that stuff in. It is much cheaper right now to rent than it is to own, especially in markets like San Diego, but also a lot of markets in the country.
Yeah, and it's just the ROI. I call it ROH, return on happiness, like per dollar spent. It's just in the beginning, I used to think, oh, I'm just going to slum it out and I'm going to save up all my money. But then I realized, I was like, wait a second, how much more productive can I be? Like, how much more business can I do? And I, though, like really cemented it for me was I was thinking about, what is the $10 million version of myself doing? Mm. Like, where's that guy living? Who's he around? What is his routine? Like, how does he move? How does he operate? I was like, is that guy living in the basement of his apartment? No, like he's got a place that inspires him and lights him up and gets him going every single day, which is why I'm excited to be here with you in San Diego. This was where I was going to move outside of Austin, Texas, but Austin just stole the show for me. But I'm excited to get into the actual interview here, man. I just wanted to bro out with you for a second.
I've actually never been to Austin, man. I got to get out there sometime.
Happy to host.
Yeah, dude. One of my niece Courtney plays pickleball and she's engaged to a professional pickleball player. Shout out to DJ Young, who's been on the podcast recently, but they actually go to Austin a lot because it's a big pickleball city. A lot of pros play out there. But the last thing I'll say about it before we move on is I actually feel like I'm a believer that when you elect to get the nicer thing or spend up into the nicer things, Dave Ramsey might not agree with this sentiment, but it forces you to think bigger. And it forces you to look at bigger dollars amounts and realize that they're really pretty small. And I think just having that mindset shift allows you to think abundantly and not from a place of scarcity. And that's where a lot of the growth has happened for me.
Mm-hmm. So I think an important thing to say is we're both renting nice places. And for me, my dream apartment, and for you, I would assume the same. And we're not paying that out of pocket. We're paying that with our real estate and with our businesses. For people that are unfamiliar, who is Rich Summers? What do you do? Why are people listening today?
Yeah, man. So I grew up middle class. My mom was an immigrant from Taiwan. My dad grew up in Holland. And I was raised like most people from a young age to go to school, get good grades, go to college and get a job. And for the most part, that's what I did. Got my first sales job in college. I was the one selling cell phones for Singular Wireless at the mall. And this is before everyone had cell phones.
Man,
and
got so, grit.
Yeah. And so people would come home from like deployment and they would pick up four new phones for their family. And yeah, I was slinging that. And dude, I was always very competitive because I played baseball, basketball, and I skateboarded growing up. And when I got into slinging cell phones, I always wanted to be the best. And so I became pretty good doing that. And then a couple of my buddies went on to sell cars for Nissan, and they were like, dude, come over and work with us, you'll make more money. And so I started slinging Nissans for my last couple of years in college, and dude, I loved it. And so I thought, man, I want to graduate college and I want to sell commercial real estate. And so I interviewed with CB Richard Ellis and Grubb and Ellis, two commercial real estate brokerages, and this is 2008 when the economy was coming down. And they both told me at the time, they said, hey, we love your hustle, we think you'd be great for it, but this is not the right time to get into the industry. They pulled those internship positions, and I found myself on a car lot wondering, what am I going to do with my life? And I stumbled across a job as an air traffic controller with the FAA. And they said, hey, if you could pass a drug test and if you can be out in Oklahoma City in 2 weeks, we'll hire you. And I said, yes, let's do it. And packed up a suitcase and basically left everything behind and rolled out to Oklahoma City and started this next chapter of my life. I ended up doing that job for 11 years. Loved it. Met some really cool people along the way. I worked 6 years at LA Center and 5 years at SoCal Approach. Basically what it is, you got two forms of air traffic control. You got the guys in the tower that work basically the taxiways. They clear the planes to take off and they clear the planes to land. But before they clear a plane to take off, they always got to get the approval from the center or the approach controllers, which is what we were doing. And basically what that is, it's radar. So there's these big dark buildings, no windows. They're all over the country. Every major city has one. And there's like 300 controllers working in these big dark buildings with no windows. And there's 45 radar scopes in these buildings. And you're just responsible for basically you got a headset on, You're looking at a radioscope, almost like a video game. You are talking to pilots of these aircraft, and some are descending, some are climbing. You're sequencing them to come in and land. You got mountain ranges, you got weather. And so sometimes, you know, it could be slow. You're talking to three or four airplanes and you're like not really paying attention. You're shooting the shit with your coworkers. Or sometimes it's busy. You got thunderstorms, you got weather, and you got 25 aircraft that you're talking to, and it's go. You got to be on point. So I did that for 11 years. Dude, I loved it. But along the way, man, I would say 9 years in, I got to a point in my life to where I no longer felt like I was growing and I no longer felt like I was progressing. And I was in the break room. I remember this so vividly. I was in the break room and I overheard a coworker talking about how he just closed on a fourplex in Cleveland. And I thought it was the coolest thing ever. I was like, how did you do that? I was like, teach me how you did that. And he said, go read this blue book by Brandon Turner on real estate investing. And he said, go listen to this podcast. And it was the Bigger Pockets podcast. And literally for 9 months, dude, I just started binge listening to this podcast. I just started reading books. I started going to networking events before I even owned any real estate. And I just became obsessed. We talk about seasons a lot. I went through a season for 9 months to where I didn't go out. I stopped dating and I literally just worked 56 hours a week. A lot of overtime as an air traffic controller, 6 day work weeks, weekends, holidays. And on the way to work, on the way back home from work and like in the break room, I just consumed podcast episodes. I read books and I just became obsessed. And I was like, dude, I wanted it so bad. I was like, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Mm. And about 9 months in, I thought it was time to take action. I cashed out my 401k. That was my seed money to get started. That literally all I had in my name. So it was like 11-year government employee. All I had in my name was about a $350,000 401k balance. And I cashed that out. I was willing to risk it. And I cashed it out. Paid the 10% penalty to the Fed, paid the 2.5% penalty to the state of California. It's taxed as ordinary income. And so I took that money. I bought a 11-unit building in Cincinnati. It's my first deal. I still own that deal. I'm actually selling it right now as we speak. But bought that for $350,000. And I took whatever I had left and I put it into a 32-unit building with the guy that was in the break room that just closed on a fourplex in Cleveland and another air traffic control buddy. The three of us all bought this 32-unit building in Indianapolis. We bought it for 1.1 and some change. And those were my first two deals, bro. And yeah, I ended up selling that 32-unit a couple years later for 3.1. Did a cash out refi with this 11-unit. Learned how to raise private money. Started a podcast shortly after that and started doing bigger deals. And about a year, actually it was only 13 months after I did my first deal, I walked away from the government pension. I walked away from the job security of having a government job. And I went full time into real estate investing and started building out my own thing. And this is only 5 years ago. And today I got about $80 million of real estate, boutique hotels, apartment buildings, and short-term rentals. And we got a cool company, podcast studio here, and we self-manage. We got a couple companies and we're rocking and rolling, dude. And now I feel like I'm just getting warmed up, man. I'm 38. At 33, dude, when I started, I was like, I was plateaued and I felt like I wasn't growing. And now at 38, dude, I feel like I'm younger than I've ever been. I feel healthier than I've ever been. I'm locked in, I'm focused. I feel like I'm just getting warmed up right now. My biggest takeaway, Brian, looking back, dude, is when I cashed out my 401k, man, everyone told me not to do it. My coworkers, friends, colleagues, even family members, they told me it was too risky. And my biggest takeaway looking back is all those risks are real. So put some weight on them. But on the other side of the balance scale is another risk. And it's this. I could be 80 years old one day, laying in my bed, staring at the ceiling, kicking myself because I never fucking tried anything in life. How about that risk? That's a risk too that a lot of people don't allude to.
Yeah. Dude, that's super powerful. And there's a quote I really call choose your hard. Mm. It's like marriage is hard. Divorce is hard. Choose. Obesity is hard. Being overweight is hard. Being healthy is hard. Choose.
Yeah.
Choose the hard. Choosing the hardness of entrepreneurship versus choosing the heart of, I'm not going to be able to do anything that I want until I'm 65 years old, right? And you made your decision. You can't escape hard, but you can choose. And you made your choice.
Dude, I'll take it a step further, man. We talk about what's hard, fucking being deployed and going and fighting a war for freaking 9 months and being away from your family while your wife's cheating on you.
That's
like hard. That fucking happens to a lot of people that are deployed. Think about that. You're out putting your life on the line and you got kids back home and your wife is out banging other dudes. That happens to a lot of people that are deployed. That's fucking hard. And you don't even know if you're going to come home. That's hard. Having cancer is hard. Having a family member that has cancer, that's hard. But going to a networking event or listening to a podcast,
exactly,
or meeting with a mentor on how you can better yourself and buy a piece of real estate or cashing out your 401k, that's not fucking hard, dude. Going to the fucking gym in the morning, that's not fucking hard.
Yeah.
Kidding me?
It's all about perspective.
Yeah.
And I want to hit on the other side of perspective too. It's funny. We see this over and over again in Action Academy and the people that we talk to. It's just whatever environment you're exposed to is what you view as normal. And so it's really just a mad dash to getting exposure to people doing large deals as fast as humanly possible, because then you just see that they're not any smarter than you. They don't have any extra edge. It's just, it's always been possible. You just chose to go smaller because that's what you were around. Mm-hmm. And so I want to hit on this from a couple of different angles. Angle number one was the guy that was talking to you about the 4 unit in the break room. There's so many people that are listening to this podcast that are doing that. Like, they're starting off, maybe it is their first 4 unit and they're not sharing it with anybody. But if that guy hadn't have talked about that freaking 4 unit, that wouldn't have set forth the trajectory that is Rich Summers today.
Totally.
So it's just so important to share your freaking story. And like, you ended up partnering with this guy, and so many people go around and they're just like, how could I raise capital? There's no way I could raise capital. You raised capital in your break room. You know what I mean? So it's just, it all goes back down to sharing your story and then being open to getting into those environments and that next level, right? Because you did an 11 unit, and what was the other one? Like a 30 unit for your first
11 unit. And then literally 3 weeks later, closed on a 32 unit building with the gentleman who actually told me about the fourplex in Cleveland. And actually, it's funny, he just came on the podcast a month ago. And when I opened the show, I was like, dude, I got to give you all the credit, because if you didn't mention that in the break room, none of this probably would have happened. And I'd probably still be working radar scopes. Literally. Think about that, man. And I think that's a takeaway for anyone listening to this show right now, is anyone out there that's scared to put themselves off on social media because they don't feel like they're qualified and they don't want to document their journey. Think about where, his name is Mike. Shout out Mike. Think about where Mike was at the time. He just bought his first fourplex. And yeah, a lot of people wouldn't think they're qualified to talk about it. But he mentioned it and he was talking about it. And I was like, that is the fucking coolest thing ever. You never know who you're going to inspire. And he inspired the shit out of me. And dude, I took it and ran with it, bro.
Yeah. And then you were just, nobody told you that it wasn't possible for you to buy the 11 unit and the 30 unit. Like, you went from 0 to 40 units quickly. Mm-hmm. Nobody told you, because nobody told you it wasn't possible.
Yeah.
You're just like, of course I would. Like, why wouldn't I? Mm-hmm. And I'm in a group chat right now where it's just people are making $400,000, $500,000 a month. I'm like, of course I would do that. Why wouldn't I? I could see them doing it. And it's so important. Before we move on, I want to talk about the decision to cash out your 401k. Because I did the same. I paid the penalty. I was like, I'll pay the 10%. I'll pay the taxes. I use that to buy my first property as well. I'm curious about your perspective. Why did you do that as opposed to loaning from your 401k?
Because when you take a loan from your 401k, most institutions can allow you to take a loan up to 50K or typically half of your account balance, whatever is the lower of the two. And so with the one I had, it was the Thrift Savings Plan, which is like most federal government employees. It's a TSP. They limit you. So I was basically capped at 50K. And so for me, I'm like, I can empty this whole thing and I can wait to pay the taxes until next year. Cause it was like, you know, you don't pay the taxes typically till the next year on those, that kind of stuff. And so I was like, I'm going to take the whole thing. I'm going to go all in. And I'm glad that I did. 50K is not a ton to play with. So I'm like, give me the whole thing. And actually what happened was they said, you can take everything except for the government match money. And I said, okay. So I took all that out. And then shortly after that, the pandemic hit. And right when the pandemic hit, they said, there was some sort of bill that came out and they said, you can empty your full 401k, even the match money. And then I was like, thank you. Yeah. Took the rest of it.
Dude, I love that. It's all about taking your first calculated risk and having it play out, getting on base and going from there.
I was thinking about the word. I was like, what the fuck is the word? It's the 401k custodian. Most custodians only allow you to take up 50K or half the account balance. Custodian was the word I was looking for.
Yeah, I despise 401ks. I think for 99% of the people, yeah, maybe it's the best bet. But like for the entrepreneurs that are out there, like the 401k is designed for you to make less money later on.
Yeah.
And then, okay, cool. Now I'm going to pay the taxes on that when I'm making less money. But I'm like, dude, if I'm doing this the way that I want to do it, I'm going to be making 100 times more money when I'm older.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? I'm going to be paying more taxes. And so I'm like, I'm putting away all this money into this account that I'm not allowed to touch and play with. Like, it's my money and you're telling me my rules for my money. So I did the same thing. I cashed it out, paid the 10%. Obviously, I wouldn't recommend that if you don't have a plan, but you and I both had a plan and we deployed it. And then the cash on cash was phenomenal. And the rest is history, right?
Dude, I have 5 or 6 reasons why I'm not a big fan of the 401k and why it's a broken system. However, I will say, like you mentioned, for the folks out there that don't have a plan in place, do it.
Sure.
Because the government match money or whatever it is. Think about me, dude. At the time, if I didn't have that 401k, I don't think I would be doing what I'm doing right now, because I wouldn't have went out there and raised money for my first deal. So I needed to have that seed money. And so the fact that I just contributed and I got that match in like over 11 years, yeah, it grows. It doesn't grow as fast as you think, but it grew. And that was there. And that was my seed money to get started. And I think for any of the folks listening, if you don't have a plan in place, at least do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the topic that I'm most excited to talk to you about is going to be boutique hotels, because people that are listening to the podcast and have seen my content know that's a space that I'm getting into.
It's the next big thing, bro.
Yeah. And I think you move the same way that I do, where it's just as soon as we get the idea of where we're going, I'm like, who are my people that I need to meet? And I was like, who is in this space? And you kept popping up. And I would talk to Brittany and then she'd be like, yeah, Rich is doing this. I talked to Soli and she's like, Rich is doing this. I talked to Dave. And then so now it's cool to be over here. And I was excited to interview you, man, because I was just like, this is a really cool wave. Why boutique hotels? More importantly, why isn't this a big thing today?
Yeah, dude, it's crazy. There's not a lot of people out there that are talking about it. So I got into real estate and I was doing a lot of multifamily and I was doing some short-term rentals as well. And in 2021, cap rates were compressing. This is when interest rates were like under 3%. And there was just a lot of demand and a lot of money that was being thrown at multifamily. And we're underwriting deals. Like these are larger deals at the time. And we're looking at some of the pricing guidances that at some of these multifamily deals, and they didn't even make sense. Mm-mm. And a lot, we would circle back with the broker and be like, yeah, we got 45 property tours this week, 32 offers, and they'll have a call for offers date. And by the time you get to less than final, it's dude, people were like overpaying. We're circling back to even see like pricing guidances that didn't make sense. We're trading at $4 to $5 million over the pricing guidance. And I was like, dude, this is like a waste of our time. What are these people looking at? And unfortunately, a lot of those people got caught with floating rate debt. And like, we're seeing a lot of those deals go back right now. I was just interviewing
the bridge debt.
I just interviewed the apartment rock star out in Houston, Robert Martinez, and shout out to him for talking about this story. But he just foreclosed on a $51 million multifamily loan. And he was one of those buyers that was buying on a lot of aggressive assumptions at that time.
And a lot of them are doing it the right way. They're increasing the NOI. They're raising the rents. They're doing something's the right way. But dude, now with the interest rates, they just can't refinance.
Dude, I'll tell you right now, man, there's a lot of multifamily operators out there, a lot of big names. I'm not going to say any names, but I know a lot of big name multifamily operators right now.
Most of them
that aren't doing distributions right now.
And it's the people that run the podcast.
Yeah. And a lot of those people are quiet right now. I saw the writing on the wall. And so I was building out a short-term rental co-hosting business in 2021 to operate my properties. But also I was like, if we're building out a team, we might as well start operating for other people's properties. And so we started managing, and we manage in 8 markets around the country, and we manage for third party owners on a select basis. And so I had this management company, and then I had all my skills of multifamily, and I'd already done a couple of multifamily syndications. So I knew what it was like to underwrite and raise money for multifamily. But I was like, what if we do a boutique hotel and we do a self-check-in, self-checkout model with the guests? This would allow us to bring the manager's unit online for additional revenue, but also eliminate the expense of having a manager on payroll. And then that just drops to the bottom line. And because boutique hotels is commercial real estate and not residential real estate, the more I can increase the income and the more I can decrease the expenses, the more I can force my appreciation, giving me more control over the valuation, which I love. And so we did the first one. It was 10 units beachfront up in Northern California, an area called Shelter Cove. And it's up by the Oregon coast, but beautiful black sand beaches, beautiful sunsets, good hiking trails. Bought it from a mom and pop seller. This guy and his wife had owned the property for 18 years. This is the only piece of real estate they'd had ever owned. And they were like remote owners and they were just never around. And this property never exceeded $180,000 in any year they owned it. And they actually sold it to us for less than what they had paid for 18 years ago. And if you think about the appreciation over California over the 18 years, it's crazy to think about. So we bought it for 1.5. They seller financed 70% of it. And we renovated the property. Did a nice reno, nice redesign. We put about 450 into it and we bought it for 1.5. We took the income from 180 to almost $700,000 in 12 months. We took the valuation from 1.5. 12 months later, it appraised at 4.5. We tripled the value. And that's when that was my proof of concept. I'm like, okay, let's do more of these. And so then started the boutique hotel fund and I just started ripping on it, dude. But yeah, I can give you like 10 reasons of why boutique hotels are going to be the next big thing, man. It's crazy.
Dude, I love it. And on that note, I want to hit on boutique hotels a lot here. We have a lot of people that do short-term rentals that were joining Action Academy. And in the beginning, I was just like, oh yeah, that's cool. And I feel like we've had this wave of short-term rentals that people have made millions of dollars. And I've interviewed a lot of them as well. Like everybody that's doing short-term rentals in that space, I've interviewed them on this podcast. But today, with regulations, with interest rates, people coming to me and saying, Brian, how do I replace $10,000 to $30,000 a month of passive income, quote unquote passive? I'm like, I don't see the scalability in the short-term rental market, especially with all these regulations and all these rules. So I'm like, why would you do short-term rentals at all and not just focus on boutique hotels, which is like the equivalent of, instead of focusing on like a single family, you're buying a multifamily. Instead of doing a short-term rental, you're doing a boutique hotel. Like,
yeah.
Why are people not putting two and two together? Am I missing something?
Here's the thing. When the masses are doing it, it's a sign that you're going the wrong direction, right? And
everybody's cousin.
Everybody's talking about, you don't even have to own the real estate to do STR or Airbnb now. Everyone's educating on it. And yes, there was a big boom. And I think there was a big boom There's a ramp up period, I would say 18, 19, 20, and then 21, there was a big boom. And the reason for that is because we had COVID. And so everyone was traveling domestically. And so because of that, there was a big boom in domestic travel that year. And so people started seeing these crazy numbers. And then in 22 and 23, they're like buying based on the 21 numbers, which dropped off as international travel opened back up. And also there was stimulus money. Everyone got $1,400 checks. There was a lot of inflation, a lot of money that was printed. And so people needed somewhere to go spend their money, right? And so I think that inflated the numbers a little bit. But with the regs tightening, we just saw what happened in New York City. They just banned short-term rentals. Here in San Diego, where we live, they took it from 16,000 short-term rentals to 5,500. And this trend is continuing in a lot of markets around the country. And as that happens, it's bringing more demand back to the hotels, right? And then also, you got 40 million baby boomers retiring in the next 7 years. It's estimated that 25% of the hotels out there are owned by the retiring boomers. And so it's a massive opportunity for us to come in and pick up their properties at a discount. A lot of their properties haven't been renovated in decades. They're not utilizing any technology. So for us to come in and pick up the properties at a discount in good locations, but do a nice renovation and force appreciation, but also implemented a lot of technology. A lot of these owners, like the one that we bought up north, the first one, the seller was just relying on a direct booking website and wasn't utilizing any of the OTAs.
Oh my God.
Just by us coming in and turning on the OTAs, Expedia, Hotels.com, Booking.com, Airbnb, Vrbo, all that stuff, increased the income alone without us throwing any money at the property. And then we did the nice renovation and social media, and now that thing's dialed. And there's a massive opportunity out there because of that. So I'm excited, and I think it's going to be the next big thing. When I go to these real estate conferences, everyone's, yo, Rich, I cannot wait to do my first boutique hotel. All those Airbnb investors, it's the next natural progression for all of them. If you can manage 7 or 8 short-term rentals, you can manage a boutique hotel. And so I think it's going to be the next big thing, which is why I think it's important to learn how to do it now.
100%. I completely agree. So I'm curious because me and you just did your show.
You ripped it.
Thank you, man. Thank you. I talked about my investment thesis when it comes to boutique hotels. And I want to look into the camera and tell people this. Why is Brian Lubin doing boutique hotels? I will answer to you, dear customer, dear investor, dear potential partner, because it's fucking sick. That's why. It's fun, dude. I get lit up by it. And we talked about the concept of going from me to we. All of my life, for me, a 10 out of 10 moment is walking into a property that is just like the coolest thing ever. That's my greatest ROH, return on happiness for dollars spent. And if I'm going to Dubai, I'm staying at the Royal Atlantis. If I'm going to Singapore, I'm staying at the Marina Bay Sands. I'm obsessed with hospitality and it really fires me up alone, personally, as I've traveled around the world and I've stayed in probably 1,000 hotels at this point. And then going from that, hosting other people and doing these events and watching their reaction and walking into a property that I like provided to them, just like completely, that was an 11 out of 10. Watching people come into these $20 million mansions that I rented for them in Cabo, I was just like, oh my God, I get to provide this experience for others. That's my investment thesis. So it's like, what's your tactical investment thesis? So you just gave some ideas right there. You know, it's going to be boomers shifting just like the small business market, silver tsunami. And then it's like great opportunities with technology advancements. Is there anything else that you would add to your investment thesis when people ask?
Yeah. So right now we're in a high interest rate environment. And it's important to remember in the boutique hotel space, all these boomers bought their properties 20, 30, 40 years ago on seller financing. And so it's the one asset class out there that the sellers are already expecting to sell on seller financing. And so that gives us a huge opportunity in a high rate environment to go in and negotiate our own interest rate, our own down payment, which more leverage, low money down often, which is great. But also what makes a good candidate for seller financing in the real estate space? It's someone that's not going to take their proceeds to buy more real estate. They're not going to do a 1031 exchange.
They don't want to do 10.
They're going to retire. And what do people want in retirement? They want low taxes and they want cash flow. They want passive income. And so now we're solving two problems. We're going to lower your tax burden and we're going to give you cash flow ongoing in your retirement. And there's one thing I don't hear a lot of real estate investors talk about. When you do a seller finance deal and like the seller that the Black Sands Inn up there, up north, we've been paying them, him and his wife, cash flow every single month. And we just took their property from 1.5 to 4.5. And now what does that do? That builds a lot of trust. And when I go to pay back that note a couple of years from now, guess what's going to happen? They're going to give me that money right back. They're going to become my largest investor. Think about that. That's a powerful thing. And now I get to help them in retirement. But you're also parlaying that into more investor capital. And I think the seller financing thing is a massive opportunity right now.
It's definitely a win-win situation. Yeah. So a question for me is, and obviously this is personal because like a buy box for you is different than a buy box for me than for somebody else. But for you guys at Summer Capital, what's a great deal look like? What's a good deal look like? What's an okay deal look like? And what's some reasons that you would pass on a property? What are your buy boxes? And what are some red flags that people look out for to avoid?
Yeah, good question. So right now, I think it's important for listeners to realize we are in a high interest rate environment and we are in a declining market. Mm-hmm. The market is softening, and I think it's going to continue to soften before it improves, right? Cap rates are increasing, and I don't think the rates are going to be going down anytime soon. And I think in order for me to do a deal right now, I need two things. I need one, to be able to buy the discount, but number two, I need to be able to add tremendous value. In an increasing market, you can buy turnkey stuff where there's not a lot of value to be added and you can do pretty good. But in this climate, that's not the case. So for me to do a boutique hotel, I want to buy in a great location. You cannot replace the location. But number two, I need to be able to buy at a discount, and then I need to be able to add tremendous value. I like to be able to at least 2x the value of the property and have a clear path to do that with conservative underwriting in a 12 to 18 month span. I'll give you an example. Black Sands Inn, we bought for 1.5, appraised 12 months later, 4.5. The most recent one that we closed on up in Sonoma Coast last month, we bought this property. It was built in 1988, 44 units, waterfront up in Sonoma Coast, California, wine country, Northern California. All 44 units have bay views. It was built in 1988 by the seller's family. Stayed in the family this entire time. The father had passed away 2 years ago. The son took it over. He had poor management in place, poor operation. Occupancy started dipping. This thing's spiraling out of control. It was doing 22% occupancy when we picked it up.
Damn.
And he did not want the staff to know that it was being sold. So he told the broker, hey, just shop this off market with a couple buyers. One of the members of our mastermind caught wind of it and brought it to us. And we ended up partnering with a couple members in our mastermind. Britt, investor girl Britt, actually partnered with us on this deal. And we just moved quick, dude. We went to LOI quick, went under contract quick. And we ended up buying it for 6.9 and a quarter after the seller credit. The appraiser who appraised it, he went to our website after the appraisal and filled out the invest form because he was like, dude, you guys are stealing this property. It appraised at 10.6 as is. In a stabilized value of 14 north. And so we're putting 2.2 into this thing. And so now we're going to have a deal that we bought for 6.9 and a quarter. We're going to put $2 million into it. It's going to be worth 14, 15 when we're done. Our loan amount on that's going to be about five and a half on a deal that's worth 14 or 15 million. And so at that time, we'll do a nice cash out refi, hit our investors up nicely, and keep rocking and rolling, dude. So that's one example.
$7-8 million equity swing.
Yeah. And that's one example of a deal. And the cool thing about it, to your point earlier, man, about it's a sexy asset class to be investing in. And when we were doing C-class apartments before, and I still own a decent amount of C-class apartments, yeah, it's cool. And people doing self-storage, yeah, it's cool, but it's like not really that sexy, right? Or mobile home parks and all that stuff. It makes money, but it's not sexy. The boutique hotel with a design element, you can take an old property and make it beautiful. But the cool thing for investors is, dude, they get to go stay at these properties and check them out. And we do grand openings after we renovate it. We'll bring all the investors out, give them a chance to meet each other. We'll do like wine tastings and all that sort of thing, dude. And yeah, it is a much sexier thing, especially on social media too.
Yeah.
You do the before and afters. People love a good before and after design element. So I got people like Brian Malone, Larky, who's been on the podcast. He's like on Top Chef. He's got a bunch of like famous restaurants. He's freaking hitting me up. He wants to like collab on a boutique hotel deal. I'll bring the food and beverage. You do the hotel portion. I got Tarik Al-Musa reaching out. He wants to do a boutique hotel deal. I'll bring capital. I'll bring some TV exposure. I don't know, man. It's a sexy thing. People like it. And I believe it's going to be the next big thing. I'm speculating, of course. And as always, I'm willing to be wrong, but that's where I think things are going.
No, I'm with you, man. I won't call for the downfall at Airbnb, but people are definitely getting pissed off and fed up with them. Like even myself, like now I've pivoted away from whenever I stay, it's half short-term rentals, half like traditional hotels. And totally. So I'm looking for boutique hotels, I'm looking for luxury hotels. But we're talking about the asset being sexy, but how you closed it wasn't sexy. And I listened to your podcast episode on it, and I fucking loved every single second of it. I was just like, I was drawn to it. I was like, tell me more, feed me more of this misery. Mm-hmm. Because we have these ideas, right? Because we're both visionaries. So you have this idea, this is what I'm going to go do. And you're like, oh, of course, we're going to just go buy a $6 million property, raise capital for it, whatever. Walk us through what happened with the rain. Because, dude, there's so many things that people don't account for in water remediation damage. Yeah. And a difficult seller that's not wanting to negotiate is definitely a hiccup. Walk through what happened and how you overcame it.
Totally. I'll first say no transaction ever goes as planned. And ironically, the transaction that we had closed on in December before this one went really smooth. I was telling the team, like, were like signing the loan docs, and I was like, guys, I was like, this is weird. Like, it's been the smoothest freaking deal we've ever done. Like, the capital raise went really quick. There was no hiccups. It was just flowed. And that was a good one because we were picking it up direct from our lender.
Makes me so anxious.
Yeah, we were picking it up directly from our lender. So I wanted it to go as smooth as possible because they're going to have more deals go bad. And so I want to be lined up for that, those bad deals. But anyways, so this one, we ended up getting under contract for $8 million. And then we found a bunch of stuff, balconies to be repaired, and there was some stuff. We already knew that it had potential water damage and issues. And so we retraded from 8 to 7. So we already got a discount there. And along the escrow period, the seller, we find out that he hasn't paid his taxes on the property. So when you have a hotel, you pay TOT taxes to the city. He hadn't paid them for 3 years. And so we didn't know the exact dollar amount, but we knew it was like close to $1 million, about $800,000 of back taxes. And so titles, hey, we can't close until we figure this out and figure out exactly what the amount is. And he needs to file his tax returns for the property. So we put the whole thing on hold and we're like, hey, when you file your taxes, let us know, and then we can close 21 days after that. And so finally, he lets us know when we get the ball rolling again. So that was like a stop and go. There's always a couple of stop and goes, at least with this transaction.
Hurry up and wait.
Yeah, yeah. And so as an entrepreneur, a real estate investor, it's like, okay, we're going to stop now. Now we're waiting for the seller. So I'm like focusing my attention on other parts of the business. And then, oh, here we go. Let's go again. And we're about to close. And we're in the closing week. And I remember I had a podcast. Ryan Garland actually was in here. And I was about to sign loan docs the next day. And I was like, hey, guys, the seller stopped operating the property. There's no one on this property for the last 2 months. We need to walk all these units because there was record rainfall in the end of January. And I was like, it would be dumb of us to close without walking all these units. And sure enough, we walked the units. And dude, six or seven of the rooms had a lot of water damage. The ceilings were like caving in. It was like bad. And we sent our remediation team up there. This is right before a podcast. I told the lender and I told the broker, I said, we're not closing. And I said, we need an extension. We need to get our remediation team up there. So we flew our remediation team up there a couple of days later, and they go up there and they're like, oh yeah, I saw this on property. Looked like someone had just painted the ceilings like over the water damage, over the mold. It's like fresh paint. There's like still a lot of like moisture in all these ceilings. And there's definitely a lot of mold behind the drywall. And yeah, so we went back and forth. They didn't want to give up any more money. And actually the seller found me. This had never happened before, but the seller found me on social media and I was marketing the deal. We're in the middle of a capital raise and marketing the deal. And of course I'm going to put the deal in the best light. And so I'm like, I put on social media, I'm like, hey, we're picking it up for this price. This is what it appraised for. And I actually included copy of the appraisal on social media. Just, you know, I want people to know, hey, like I don't fluff stuff. Everything I talk about is legit. But he found me and the broker is like, hey, dude, the seller saw the appraisal. He wants me to take this back to market. He's fucking pissed, blah, blah, blah. And it was this whole thing, bro. And I'm thinking like, fuck. And my legal counsel was like, dude, you got to be careful because there's like a CA agreement in the contract that says that you're not going to put anything out there until closing. And so I'm like, hey, let's get the seller to sign a waiver. We need a discount. That we're outside of the timeline. Now we're past the close of escrow date. We're technically in breach of contract. However, the seller is in breach of contract because he was not going to disclose all this water damage.
Mm-hmm.
See, we're going back and forth. We got legal counsels in there, SEC counsels in there, and it was like a grueling 2 weeks. And then I said, we're not going to close without an additional concession. It's just not going to work because the time of the 6 down units, now that's loss of income for us. And then the cost to fire a team up there and remediate this and to do proper remediation and proper mold testing to make sure these rooms are habitable. That costs a lot of money. In 2 weeks, finally got the credit and they signed the waiver. So good to go.
Passive income.
Yeah. And I know, right? Passive income.
Yeah.
Just like that. Dude, I don't know. Every deal is different, but guess what? I learned a lot. And now the next deal, I'm that much more confident and that much better. And dude, it's the ups and downs and the things that we don't plan for, don't expect, all the challenges that are thrown our way. Yeah, it can feel overwhelming, but dude, I'll tell you what, man, that's how we fucking grow as real estate investors. Like without the overwhelming stuff, without the challenges, there would be no growth. And one takeaway I have is looking back, man, it's like things get overwhelming before the level up. And that's just how life works. That's how the game works, dude.
Yeah, I interviewed Dan Martell and he said problems aren't problems, they're puzzles.
Mm.
Because if you're having problems, if you're not having problems, you're not growing. You're not operating your business. You're living in a little styrofoam existence. If you are experiencing a lack of problems in your life, it means that you're not pushing hard enough.
Totally.
So problems are a good indicator of growth. You're moving in the correct direction if you're running into problems.
So good.
My question is, emotionally, how do you regulate yourself going through that process? Because even myself, I find that I'm sometimes all over the place as an entrepreneur, and because I'm new to the game, and it's like I have success and I'm proud of myself. People that are 20 years deep, like, their main claim to fame is, yo, I've gotten punched in the face and kicked in the dick in 30 different languages. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's just, what's some advice you can give to somebody that's new in the game about the emotional regulation through the inevitable stuff?
It's something that I've gotten better with over time and with reps, but I think a good leader is someone that can analyze something and step out of a conversation and get some like crazy news, maybe it's a death or some really terrible news about what's going on, and then jump into a whole nother meeting and have a smile and be, hey, how you doing today? And make it about them. And always being calm and collective. I think that's major. I think the second that you're distraught or you feel like, oh my gosh, I'm overwhelmed, now that energy is going to vibrate with your entire team and it's going to affect their ability to cope with it as well.
I'm guilty of being over. Like, I sent an email today where I'm just like, yo, I'm feeling it. Like,
yeah.
We need to like, you focus on this, you focus on this, mm-hmm. you focus on this. I'm overwhelmed right now. But like, like you said, it's a bad look.
I think realizing like everything is temporary. That feeling of being overwhelmed is temporary. But what else is temporary is success. And so I always realize the highs are never as high as they really are, and the lows are really not as low as they really are. And so I've just learned to become numb to all this stuff. When I think it's the reps, but also really knowing that like when shit feels overwhelmed, I know the level up is about to happen, and that's what keeps me excited, and that's where the growth happens. Without feeling overwhelmed, I get bored. I'm addicted to it, dude.
You're addicted to chaos.
It's the fucking game, man.
Yeah, we're all addicted to chaos. Dude, yeah, it's difficult for me to sit still because it's part of ADD. Most of us are ADD as entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
But like for me, it's like if I'm not doing something or working on something massive, it's just like being still is the most difficult part.
Mm-hmm.
So in closing, one last question, which is capital. Yeah. So you've obviously done a great job of raising capital, mm-hmm. doing it in a way where in stressful environments, you still pulled it through. You still made sure your investors were taken care of.
Sure.
You pulled off some successful deals. If you go back to talk to Rich at the very beginning, and that guy's, yo, I'm ready to start raising capital to do these big deals. I don't want to do the small shit. I want to do the big deals. What are some piece of advice or observations you can give to him where you're like, hey, dude, this is way easier than you think, and you're making it more difficult than it is. And then this is something that you're not even thinking about when it comes to raising capital, but it's going to kick you in the dick. What are some observations you can give to you when you were first starting?
Yeah, so I would say for someone out there that wants to raise capital for a larger deal right out the gate, make sure you're partnering with someone that has successfully done it before and leverage all of their experience, because the biggest question that investors are going to have is, have you done this before?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the proof of concept? Is my money going to be safe with you? And so if you don't have a lot of experience, then you need to partner with someone that has experience. And so whenever that comes up, you just deflect and say, yeah, this might be my first one. However, my team, my partner, our property manager has a ton of experience. That's one. The second one is that first raise, the folks that are going to invest with you are going to be people that already know and trust you. Mm-hmm. So I would say a good tip is to go into your social media, go into your phone book, and write down all these relationships that you have. You have a lot more than you think you do. Just because you haven't talked to someone in 5 years doesn't mean they're fair game. They're fair game. And the idea is write down all these people that you know and then put them into different buckets. And so most people are going to have 5 or 6 buckets. So you're going to have coworkers. You are going to have friends and family. You're going to have college friends. You're going to have people that you play maybe softball with and all these different recreational things. And so write down these different buckets. And the idea is to get at least one person to invest in all 7 of your buckets. Because now for the next deal, that's social proof. You can go to that group and say, hey, Brian invested. And now because Brian invested, guess what? Now they trust you. For example, I was on like one of our investors, shout out to Carlton Dennis. He's a real estate CPA. He's a badass. Carlton's one of our investors in our fund. And he had me on his community call a while back. And just me going on his community call and him saying, yeah, I'm an investor with Rich. We end up getting so many new investors just out of that one conversation because they trust Dennis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, try to get at least one investor out of each of those buckets and try to provide value. For us, I don't press on any investors. Our whole motto is, look, if you want to participate, great. We'd love to have you as part of our investor community. But if not, no worries. Maybe we can do something down the road. And that's it. And I think we've done a good job of kind of branding ourselves and growing ourselves. And for us, it's about the community. Hmm. It's not just investing. It's about the community aspect. We do yacht meetups. We do all sorts of cool stuff. And yeah, it's been fun, dude. And have fun with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have fun with it.
Most importantly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It occurs with different asset classes, right? Mm-hmm. So when you did multifamily, it's like, if you're going to do something different, then bring in somebody that does that. So that's exactly how I view things. Because mm-hmm. right now, I've got a lot of people that are begging me to give me money to do something. Like, hey, and to your point, it's just no trust. Like, they're like, hey, we love the vision that you talk about every single day on the podcast. We listened for 2 years. Take my money. Let's do something. I want to partner with you. Let's buy this. Let's do that. And I just said no, because it's not time yet. It's not time. And so the longer that you can delay your ask, the bigger your ask can be.
100%.
And so now it's to a point where we're a couple of years deep. And it's like, when I do something, I want to do it. Yeah, I'm learning all about this stuff. But more so what I'm doing is I'm interviewing people, like both for the podcast, but it's just, who am I partnering with on these next deals? Because like when I come out the gate, it's like, I want to do something that's like $10 million plus.
Totally.
So it's just like, who am I going to be with that's got a decade of experience mm-hmm. in this? And so it's always who, never how. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah. I'm looking for that as well.
That's good. And then the last thing I'll add to this is, you know, you want to be a good custodian of someone's money, and you mm-hmm. want to be able to sleep good at night. And if you're not partnering with someone's reputable, then you shouldn't be doing the deal. Yeah. I don't have a problem doing my own deal with my own money. And if it's my own deal, I'll do deals that require a higher risk tolerance because it's my own money, and I will lose my money before investors' money all day. Now, if I'm doing a deal with investors, our underwriting is so much tighter and our buy box is so much tighter because I want to be able to sleep good at night. But what I was going to say is, like, early on, the first couple raises for me in the apartment space, it was all friends and family, people that already knew me. And because I didn't have the track record to attract accredited investors, right?
Yeah.
And so as you progress, each deal will get easier and easier, but you got to continue to push yourself, right? And so now, now we can attract accredited investors and folks that don't know us, but they're investing because they hear, oh, boutique hotels, and then we can show them our track record. And so now we have that reputation and the track record, which is big, but it doesn't happen in the jump. I would say, dude, the ability to raise and multiply capital is the highest value skill in the world. Mm. It really is. So you think about leverage, right? You're raising money and then you're parlaying that with leverage, and then now you're multiplying it. It's a powerful thing, and it's probably the highest value skill out there in the world. I always say you need two things to build a real estate portfolio. You need capital development, so like ability to raise money or have your own money to fund these deals, and then deal development, access to good deals. If you have those two things, you can outsource everything else. But the most important thing is access to money.
I love that, man. With that being said, let's go ahead and close it out there. Where can people find out more about you? If they want to invest with you, where can they go? Where can they learn more about all this stuff?
Yeah, man. Everything's on Instagram at rich_Summers. That's SOMERS for investing. SummersCapital.com/invest. And then for the podcast, The Rich Summers Report, just had Brian on. That'll probably air here soon. Appreciate you, brother.
Man, thanks so much for coming on, man. This has been awesome. It was a pleasure being on yours as well. And let's close this out in San Diego, baby.
Yeah.
It's been Rich and Brian with the Action Academy Podcast, signing off.
Hey, real quick, if you're still listening to today's episode, I'm assuming you got value from it, so I need your help specifically. My 2-year vision with this show is to help over 1 million people do what they want, when they want, with who they want, and I can only do that with your help. There are two main ways that a podcast grows. One is through ratings and reviews, and the other is word of mouth. If you could please leave me a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as well as send this to 1 or 2 friends that you think would get value from it, we can reach the people that we're looking to reach. Thanks in advance. Talk tomorrow.